Welcome to the HIV Australia podcast, a discussion about the community-led response to HIV. In this episode, the Inukina National HIV Alliance are joined by several brother boys to discuss the impacts of racism and access to healthcare.
I'd just like to welcome everyone. Thanks for your time. Important podcast. Just to acknowledge that today we're this meeting is organised from Sydney, from Gadigal country. I'm sitting here on Yagara country at Ipswich in Queensland. Jack, do you want to introduce yourself and say where you're from?
Certainly just want to acknowledge that I'm a Wiradjuri brother boy coming from the unceded lands of the Darug people, specifically Leonomatical country, which is near the South Creek area out near Penrith.
Thanks, Jack. Taz?
Yeah, I just wanted to acknowledge the land on which I'm on, which is the Bundjalung Nation from the Widjibal Wagal peoples. So, thank you.
Max?
Yeah, I'm on Wiradjuri country here in Wagga, and Wiradjuri man, brother boy.
Okay, guys, look, welcome to the podcast for brother boys. And, thanks for giving us your time. The Black Lives Matters movement represents a catalyst for overhaul of relationships, not only between First Nations Australians, the police and the criminal justice system, but between First Nations people and the Australian community as a whole. The ANA is a First Nations representative body that works to improve the lives of First Nations people affected by HIV and sexual health. The ANA and its membership experience firsthand negative impacts of racism broadly in Australia and specifically within the health and community service sector. And the momentum in Australia is that we at Inukina are looking at, to do a series of podcasts around how our Black Lives Matter in this country. So today it's really about, like previous podcasts, we've looked at the experience, looking at the negative impacts of racism on brother boys, including the specific area of health. These impacts can also be experienced in specific ways for particular populations, and I'm talking about us, the Black queer community. So just thinking about it, what are some of these experiences felt by brother boys, particularly around racism and access to services, or issues within your community? Do you want to talk about that? Max, would you like to start off? You're living in a rural city. How might some of these aspects affect your lived experience?
I'm just thinking, like, I haven't experienced a lot of racism, probably because I am quite light-skinned. When I was growing up, I did experience it a bit in school. I've had more issues about me being a brother boy in regards to being transgender than I've experienced racism. So a lot of it is ignorance, I believe. Curiosity, because I've never met another transgender person before. But, and the health services I do access, I access the local Aboriginal Medical Centre and a lot of Aboriginal services. So I don't access a lot of mainstream services in that respect. So just to go back to your question, Colin, I myself haven't experienced a lot of racism as a brother boy, but that's probably due to I think we have quite a substantial community here, and I access a lot of Aboriginal services directly.
Okay, and how is that? Is it a fairly friendly environment? Is it a friendly atmosphere? I mean, they're treating you quite well as a client. Access for what your needs are. How is that?
I've had a lot of good experiences, but I have had a few, I wouldn't call them bad, but uncomfortable experiences in regards to, I've had to see a few specialists, and like I've got sleep apnea. So, and they said, oh, looked at me and said, oh, have to put your sex at birth and put it down. And I thought that wasn't, but it was the way that they went about it. And I've had another specialist asking me like questions like, what surgeries have you had, you know, and using words that made me feel really uncomfortable. And I feel hesitant to speak out if I said something that would be offended. So sort of went to sort of just go with it, I guess. But I think there is a lack of education, especially for primary health workers, around even just basic etiquette to treat brother boys and sister girls and transgender people, because it's like some of them do ask really inappropriate questions because they've never encountered someone before, and it's not appropriate, like when you're a health professional.
Yeah,
that's my experiences. Yeah.
Chad, do you want to talk a little bit about your lived experience, in the sense of whether it's around racial issues or whether it's around, you know, community engagement, how you look at accessing the services that you access for your health needs?
Certainly. Thanks, Colin. I think it is the intersection between the Aboriginal medical services and transgender that's kind of where some of the issues I face. I find my AMS very difficult to get an appointment with, and when I have had appointments, not necessarily around gender stuff, it has been I just didn't feel they had an understanding of how to treat a trans person. I'm lucky in the sense that my GP, though I have to travel from Penrith to eastern suburbs, had previously worked in an AMS, also has worked in remote communities, but also is a bit of a sexual health and transgender expert as well. So I feel like in the private service with a non-Aboriginal practitioner, I've I have amazing medical support, but I have to travel, even though Penrith to the city mightn't seem a large distance. But when you've got to take a day off work to get an appointment and like to go in, it is a bit of a hassle. And it would be nice if the local AMS in Penrith was a little bit more accessible to trans people. My main issues, though, has been sort of small microaggressions. Like I've had to have surgery on my reproductive area. And while the nurses were fantastic, the surgeon had to be corrected a few times for misgendering me. And also going to the chemist to get my PrEP, for instance, someone closing the gap. The chemist kind of looked at me as like, oh, I don't think you can claim that. On closing the gap, I said, oh, I think I can, why don't you run it through the computer? And oh yeah, so it's just a little bit of an education piece about, you know, there is such thing as queer Aboriginal people that have, you know, queer relationships, same-sex relationships, etc. And it's not necessarily, it's not a deliberate racism, it's more systemic racism. And I do think there is more education needed of the AMSs that queer people, queer Aboriginal people exist. It might be just my experience, but from what Max has been saying as well, it is an opportunity for some education.
And it seems like there needs to be some education of some of the some of the professionals in the sense of doctors and surgeons. And I mean, you'd think that if you're having a procedure, that the all of that would be pretty much worked out before you before anything happens. How did you feel about that?
I think I'm 46. I'm a bit older. I think I've got a bit of a bit of resilience. We shouldn't have to have resilience, but it helps. And I was kind of equally little bit disappointed with the surgeon, but also the nurses completely jumped on him and basically, you know, corrected him. So that was great. And but I think, you know, our whole sort of medical system could, like, even when you're filling out your religious forms for your surgery, if you get admitted, what's your religion? And I always put, you know, Aboriginal spiritual practices, and just to have the nurse look at you and it's like, you know, what's that? No, Aboriginal spiritual practices, like, you know, that doesn't seem to be an understanding. So I think it's, there's a little bit of racism that's still there, but also a little bit of not so much transphobia, but lack of understanding of both of these, both being Aboriginal and being queer.
Taz, how has your experience sort of, well, certainly I know that you've lived in some isolated areas, urban areas, and now in country New South Wales in Lismore, and also work there. How are things going for you at the moment? Are there any issues around around racism, or either in the workplace or in the community, or transphobia?
Yeah, I think there's definitely like transphobia, and not necessarily like it could be going out of their way to be transphobic, or it could just be miseducation. But definitely of some of the shared experiences of even the local GP here told me that he doesn't prescribe hormones to trans people, so that was a bit confusing, even though it's like the training manual for them. But that's another thing too, is I don't even know if there's really a partnership between such places like Trans Hub and Nacho, where we could be
how's that
being in Queensland, you know, Colin, you'd know yourself, but you know, you other followers might have heard of the Safe and Deadly Pathways, which was an initiative that they ran in Brisbane with the local AMS. And that was, you know, the AMS did consultation with the local community to ask them what they wanted for the AMS in terms of pathways for their community, and there was a discussion, a launch, and some pathways made. So it didn't necessarily make the problem go away, but it definitely did start the conversation and give people a general direction.
So where was that aimed at within the medical service? Well, where did they aim it? Did they aim it at a youth age group, or did they aim it at the workforce, or?
Yeah, I think it was more for the workforce to understand the community, and you know, I think there's opportunities to learn how to engage and sort of better understand their community, so their service was appropriate. But yeah, that was a long time ago. It was a long time, but yeah, it's been a couple of years, and there's been different changes in that service, I believe. But.
So was it aimed at anything like the 715 health check, or was it just generic throughout the service? And did anything eventuate around particular service around gender issues or anything like that? Was it, you know, like do you think there was something for sister girls, or do you think there was something for brother boys that might have made it easier for you to access?
Yeah, I mean, I think there was memory, the option to be able to select sister girl or brother boy, maybe when filling out the paperwork, but even if it wasn't that, there was definitely like a workplace sort of awareness. Yeah.
So if you had a wish list, what would some of the things that you'd feel more comfortable getting at an Aboriginal medical service than going to a gender clinic or wherever else? Are there places where you would access that where you feel much more comfortable, or do you think that most service providers are fairly lacking as far as their knowledge about the needs of brother boys in the medical situation? I mean, I think someone talked about the intersectionality of services before. I think, was that you, Jack? I think you touched on that. Can you explain what that might mean to you? What does that mean to you?
Well, when I make choices about my medical requirements, do I choose to go to the local AMS or do I choose to go to my GP in the city? So you kind of weigh up what services you need. And whilst for 90% of the things I get from my GP in town, I've not heard about the Aboriginal, what's it, 357 health check?
The 715.
I haven't heard about that annual health check until recently. Mm-hmm. But I also feel that my local AMS is not properly equipped to support me with my needs as a transgender person. So I kind of suppose it's both racism, not necessarily deliberate racism by my GP, she's fantastic, but it's just my non-Aboriginal service doesn't 100% across everything, but my Aboriginal service is not across transgender or queer sort of health requirements. So it's that intersection of where racism and sort of I think transphobia is a very strong word. I don't think they're deliberately transphobic. I just think there's not a large demand for it in possibly Western Sydney. But I know there's sister girls in Western Sydney. I'm not the only queer, I'm not the only, trans Aboriginal person in Western Sydney. So it's I think there is just a need for that conversation amongst all AMSs to understand that, even in rural areas like this, there's, Max is in Wagga and there's sister girls in Wilcannia and there's sister girls in Broken Hill and there's transgender Aboriginal people across the state, and it would be really good if we could all get the help we require and the support we need by our local Aboriginal services. So I think it's that intersection of it's not quite racism, it's not quite transphobia, it's just the services don't kind of fit the intersection of being a trans Aboriginal person.
So by the sounds of things you're saying, they just don't know. That they don't know what to provide.
Well, in my experience, my local Aboriginal service wasn't particularly great. My GP in Sydney is great, but as I said, that health check I didn't sort of know about. So I think there's an opportunity there as well. And I think it's just about some more resources and education for the GPs in both the world that really supports trans people. Like I go to a prominent Eastern Sydney GP clinic that has a lot of transgender and a lot of HIV, lots of people with HIV, lots of transgender customers, but the local AMS might necessarily see that client base in Western Sydney, but it's possibly more across the needs as an Aboriginal person for the medical checkups, etc. So I think it is about some education and some training and a sort of not coming from a place of you're bad or you're not doing this, you're not doing that. I think couching things as more of opportunities for support rather than giving really sort of negative feedback. In terms of the racism, I don't experience racism from my GP. It's been more about the chemist not understanding that you can get PrEP under Closing the Gap. It's been the system sort of things, and I experience more transphobia than I do racism. But yes, I think that's kind of, it's where those both two kind of meet. They're the same coin, but two different sides.
What about, and this is for all of you, what about issues around confidentiality? How does that sit with all of you? Are you comfortable with the services that you use and as far as your confidentiality is concerned? How do you feel about that?
I'll go first and then I'll throw the others. I've been completely fine. The confidential aspect of the services I've been involved with, like you have to give your date of birth and details when you make appointments, or and no longer do you get results off the phone. I'm pretty open and out in my community, in my workplace, etc. So it's not necessarily something I'm particularly concerned about.
You know, I've had no issues. Like, I know my file says somewhere I'm transgender, but I'm the same as Jack on people know me in the community. So I've had no issues with my privacy and accessing any medical services.
Yeah, I was going to say, I'm the same.
Yeah, so, that's great stuff to hear that. So just looking at some issues around how you talked a little bit about how staff deal with clients and things like that, and you talked about how that there needed to be some more training and education around working with Brother Boys. So what are some of the things that would stand out for you the most around that training that you think the Aboriginal health sector or any health provider might need as far as providing a service to you?
I think what I would like for Western Sydney, and it could already exist, I might be wrong, but I like it that any young transgender Aboriginal person could go to their local AMS and get the appropriate care they need to support their transition. Appropriate psych referrals, appropriate endocrinologists or sexual health GP referrals, complete and utter understanding, and for that particular AMS doctor to be able to talk about the risks and the complications and the side effects, but also the benefits, and just to be able to do what I get from my non-Aboriginal GP in Sydney. Like, I'm completely supported in terms of my transgender healthcare needs by my GP, and I would like for the Aboriginal medical professionals who are supporting community to be able to provide the same service and to have that sort of culture. Like, my GP is completely culturally safe. She's a beautiful woman, but she's got amazing caring for country artwork on the walls of these very intricate fish traps, and I feel very culturally safe with her. But I would like for young people, and specifically in Western Sydney, to be able to go to their local Aboriginal medical practitioner and not have to go elsewhere, not to have to travel to the eastern suburbs to get the support they need.
And then you're talking about young people.
Yeah, I'm sorry.
You're talking about an age group?
Yeah, I say specifically young people, or anybody really who's transitioning or support, but I look at the suicide rates of young queer people. Not necessarily, I don't have the statistics for the intersection of being queer and Aboriginal, but you look at statistics of suicide and self-harm suicidality in queer transgender youth. It's absolutely outrageous, and I really hope that really want for our Aboriginal trans people in Western Sydney to be able to get the support they need where they live, or anywhere on country in New South Wales, that they get the support. I was yarning with one of my elders about this, and she's quite concerned that Wiradjuri trans people have to go to the Big Smoke to get the support they need in some circumstances. So, whilst Penrith isn't that rural, and I live off country, I don't live on my country, I still have to travel to get the support that I need. So having in place, and I know our medical systems are, burdened and under-resourced and underfunded and et cetera, and it's just another thing they'll have to support. But you know what? This conversation might lead to more funding for services in both Western Sydney as well as rural areas.
Yeah, and I like that idea of focusing on young people, young trans people, other boys.
Mm.
Is certainly something that we need to look at urgently. Matt?
Yeah, I think just general like awareness and in training. Like, you know, I saw a GP at the after hours clinic the other week for my shoulder and asking me what genitals I have. So things that are really inappropriate, just the basic etiquette, you know.
It's common.
Like, you know, you tell, because I've been told you disclose all your medications, so you have to disclose you're on testosterone and what are you on that for? And then you explain. And then they ask all these inappropriate questions because they're curious, but it's not appropriate. Just basic training around how to, like, to treat trans people, don't misgender, you know, don't ask these questions. And then also accessing that medical support for transition and surgeries and other things as well. Like, I was pretty lucky that I knew someone that had seen a GP at Headspace and they were willing to see me even though I was 26, do informed consent. Whereas realistically, all GPs should be able to do informed consent. But a lot of GPs, I don't even know where to start. Like, they just totally have no idea. If they were seeing someone that was younger that doesn't have that experience or knowledge, I could imagine what a struggle that would be. And it's only that you make these connections of who you know that knows that's been through that journey and they can guide you. If you don't have another person to support you in that respect, it can be quite daunting, I guess, trying to access that specific care.
Is there something that we can put in place to stop that sort of stuff from going on? Like, I mean, I know a checklist sounds, you know, like a little bit funny, but, you know, well, what sort of education is that if they're asking inappropriate questions like that because they're curious or because of curiosity? I mean, that just seems like a little bit not right. Well, it seems like it's not right. You know that it's not right. So stop doing it. Stop.
I think.
How do we get around that?
It needs to be like there needs to be training, including so GPs that have to do so much training per year.
So is there anything within, say, places like the Gender Centre that deal with that sort of language or that sort of approach for trans people who are going through those places who need to access services and what have you, so that they don't have to put up with this sort of nonsense?
There's resources there, but they're not reaching the right people. So, like, there's Trans Sub ACON, that there's a lot of work there, AusPath, these sorts of things. But from my experience, the people that I'm having these interactions with don't know about that sort of thing. And it's sort of like this, the first transgender brother boy person that they've encountered, and I don't get misgendered now, but, like, you know, I've been on hormones. But
is there something that we can do, or AMS can do, or ANA can do, or our program that would make some of this stuff a little bit more not easy, but what's the word? We can deal with it in a more appropriate way with trans issues for brother boys and sister girls. I mean, you know, because you're saying that there are things that these people need to know. So if we develop something for Aboriginal medical services or any service that services our brother boys, sister girls, gay men, bisexuals, whatever, around specific things around gender issues, is there something that's burning there that you might be we might be able to develop?
I mean, I find it's not just Aboriginal, it's everywhere, mainstream. So I don't know how much we can do how much, you know, as a community we can do. It's an issue I'm finding everywhere if I go, whether it's some, I haven't really had any at the AMS. I have had with a psychologist before where I'm there talking about my grieving, my grandmother who's dying, and they want to just talk about me being trans. And it's like, I'm fine with that. But I think it's a general issue. And it's just brother boys and sister girls are included in that because they're included in that umbrella. I don't know what the answer is. I think
it's something that could be worked on, though. I mean
yeah.
This certainly isn't enough time to sit down and talk about that because it's just a podcast, but it's certainly something that I think that you've highlighted that we probably need.
I did have a bit of a thought, and I think when we talk about the suicide rates and we talk about young people and we talk about what's going on and what we can do, I think there is a bit of a rhetoric in the community at the moment around trans people. You know, it's not socially acceptable to pick on gay people or lesbians anymore, but it seems to be socially acceptable to pick on trans people. I think there's been a lot of deliberate dehumanising of trans people, especially in the right-wing media and the Murdoch press. And I think that, you know, if we had a program where there was volunteers, it could be organised through ACON or the Gender Centre, whoever wants to own the project, where you had volunteers that for every single, you know, so doctors that go through university, and there's not a large amount of doctors that go through university, there's lots of attrition, that you go and these volunteers go and you know, be appropriately trained, go and talk to the students when the doctors are students, and to talk about, answer any questions respectfully, and basically to kind of show that when, you know, when you talk about trans people, you're actually talking about human beings with feelings and reactions. And I think, you know, if we focus on educating people and showing the humanity of trans people through conversation, through yarning, what we're doing now, I think that will go a long way. That when you are treating a trans person, you see them as a human being first, like Max, what Max brought up about, you know, the medical professional focusing more on him being trans than what he's going through with his relative. Well, then hopefully that doctor would see see people as a human being first, and you know, medical oddity second, or the medical, you know, the trans stuff.
You're trying to dispel that myth of what they're getting at, which is,
yes,
obnoxious when you actually think, when you think about it.
Yeah, it's your patient is a human being first, regardless of what gender they are.
That's right. That's exactly right. Yeah. But what about any issues around police?
Not necessarily for being Aboriginal or being a brother boy. I have experienced negative police interactions for being perceived as being gay. I got pulled over once and asked why I was driving a hairdresser's car. I drove a little black hatchback. And this was just after the yes vote, so maybe I was a bit sensitive about it. But he basically kept on asking, you know, why am I driving a hairdresser's car? And I'm like, I'm sorry, officer, I don't know what you mean by that, which pissed him off. He asked it again, then he asked a third time, and then he just gave up. So I am lucky in the way that I move through the world. I'm particularly light-skinned. And also as a brother boy too, I feel that I pass very easily for, you know, being male. So I suspect, but I also know my sister girlfriends face a lot of harassment from the police. I think it's been my observation that in some ways, and it's been my lived experience, that sister girls tend to be on police radar more than I am because they don't actually see me as a target for their usual attention. Would you agree with that, Max?
Yeah, I haven't had any issues the same as Jack, you know. I've us quite well, and I do know a few brother boys and sister girls that have had to unfortunately go to jail, and how that's navigated with where they're put. But I don't have any sort of experience with police or that respect. I feel possibly like it's the way that brother boys and sister girls are treated is vastly different, and to do with, you know, trans misogyny and how people are perceived. So like Jack said, you know, if someone's more visible, if someone's visibly more visibly queer, they're more likely to be targeted anecdotally. But I don't have any real other feedback to give regarding that.
So do you think our community know about brother boys? Do you think is it a new thing, or is it something that, I'm talking about it in a trans situation, is it something that, does the community acknowledge that? Like, sister girls, community acknowledges sister girls, but how do you think they acknowledge our community? I'm specifically talking about the community. How our community acknowledges brother boys.
I think we're quite invisible, which goes into hand with general visibility with transgender men and trans masculine individuals. I don't know if a lot of people are aware of the terms brother boy or sister girl. I've spoken to elders about wanting to do cultural practices, and they don't even know what to tell me because they've never encountered that before. So, you know, like wanting to do for myself, without going into detail, things that men can do, what can I do? And they say they can't answer that. But I don't, even people that know about me and my journey, I don't even know if they know about other brother boys or that specific term.
So does that, do you think, you know, would you look at, just say for instance, how Two-Spirit people look at issues like that, say in Canada or in the United States, in the sense of that acceptance within their community? Or, I mean, you know, one of the things that I thought about, because I sort of grew up in that old school era type thing where, you know, girls were called tomboys and boys were called sissies. So out of that came sister girl, or, you know what I mean, sister. And then, and I'm not quite sure how we, but we did look at that. I mean, I can remember in our childhood, you know, there were girls who wanted to hang out with the boys, basically. But sometimes our intergenerational membership, interracial memory forgets things like that. And they don't, you know, they, I don't know, has anything like that ever come across, have you come across that?
I think there's now a distinction between, you know, butch women and transgender men and brother boys. I think there is that understanding of, for most people, I still have people that refuse to accept me, which isn't my problem.
I found that in the circles that I mixed in the 60s and the 70s and 80s, where our little small community that went out were really very accepting of each other, whether it was a butch girl or a queenie guy or a sister girl or however, whatever name you want to call that, or us or whatever. Yeah. So.
So you mean like in the queer Aboriginal community?
Yeah.
Yeah. Yeah. Yeah. No, I've been accepted and I'm fine, like in our community. Sorry, I thought you meant like the greater Aboriginal community.
Well, that's that too.
Yeah. There is certain in older generations lack of understanding, and I think that just comes down to just ignorance. And you know, I've had about 1% of people that probably had issues with me, and there's no skin off my nose because they're not worth worrying about. I think most people are pretty accepting, and it's just that lack of knowledge that I encounter, you know, with the cultural side of things. So
for the both of you, what are some of the things that can be done to improve the impacts on brother boys? What are some of those things that, you know, we might be able to do around access, around training, around people's perceptions, or, you know, what do you think might be some of the things that we can put in place? I suppose looking at some solutions. You talked about training, you talked about education, you talked about yarning, you could have yarning circles. I mean, you probably need to have something for yourselves as well, I think. In the sense of, well, probably one of my questions is, do you have a network?
We do have a network. We have the Sister Girl and Brother Boy Facebook group, but I really do think you've mentioned something important, Colin, because I think as brother boys and as men, we respect our sisters, respect the sister girls. And I know personally, I sometimes step backwards and let and be led by the sisters. Like, they termed the coin and they initially set up the communities, etc. And I also think, you know, the struggles that sister girls face in some ways, as Jack, Max and I talked about passing, but I do think there is a need for brother boy men's specific yarning circles. We do have an elder, and we do have, you know, there is, you know, friendships amongst the brother boys. And I think, you know, just to acknowledge that there's, you know, even within sister girls and brother boys, there's men's business and women's business. And we have a different belonging separately, like sister girls and brother boys have a different belonging as well. And I think the longer colonization took to hit a community, the more sister girl and brother boy histories and rituals and et cetera knowledge has been preserved. Like, you look at the sister girls from the Aranda, from you know, the central Northern Territory, they have stories that I as a Wiradjuri person don't, because colonization hit us a lot sooner than it did the Aranda. And I've heard other people mention as well that our roles were prescriptive but not prohibitive, and that, you know, people were treated as who they were as a person, not necessarily like white way put into a particular gender stereotype. So one of the things I'm interested in is unlocking kind of those histories and look at that. But I think, you know, for brother boys that not necessarily be separated from sister girls, but understand that we need our own specific services and yarning circles, because we step back and support our sisters. And sometimes we don't always talk about our stuff, if that makes sense.
Yeah, and I think what Jack said, like, you know, we need, in Aboriginal culture, there is, you know, men's business, women's business, and not necessarily being that strict binary, but having that different experience and culture to sister girls, where we do need to be able to talk openly, and we, you know, we're in our own small group community, and the issues that we face are similar but different.
Yeah, and I think Max he talked about that before, in the sense of, you know, there are issues that you need to talk about as brother boys, and about your maleness and about how that is with you. It could be around mental health issues, it could be around the issues and the effects of hormones, what testosterone does to your body, you know, all of those sorts of things that I'm just imagining this, that could be a part of your discussion, in the sense of, you know, the way that you work through all of that stuff as a collective and as a group of people, not only within the own state, but across the whole country. And if you actually look at it, it's much bigger than that anyway, isn't it? It's worldwide, and you know, it's about people's lifestyles and acceptance and, you know, togetherness. And, you know, because I mean, a part of the Anukara code is, you know, we're all stronger together, because that's where it actually came from. Because as in small groups, all of that, trans women, trans men, bisexuals, gay men, lesbians, as a small black queer group, that's what made us stronger, was actually being together. And I, you know, this thing that you talk about with brother boys and sister girls, the issue there is around trans. Although there might be different circumstances, there is a sameness there. And I mean, that's for all of us. So, have you got any things that you'd like to talk about just to wind it up? Is there anything that's really burning that you wanna throw out there? Whether it's a challenge or whether it's something for young brother boys, young folk, is there anything that you wanna talk to, you know, to say to the service providers or whoever, whether they're health workers or community or whatever? Fire away.
I just think, you know, what Jack said, you know, that we're human beings, and my issue, I think, is that I know people are curious, but, you know, just have some dignity and respect. And I think if they're needing to be, they're wanting knowledge, instead of, you know, asking a transgender or brother boy or a sister girl inappropriate questions, they can research, you know, educate yourself, because more than likely, as a medical practitioner, they will encounter someone that will need their help. And I just think, you know, it gets old quickly, you know, being asked these questions, and it makes you, like, you know, I've got thick skin now, but I just think if you're wanting to know these things, then there are resources to educate yourself, like Trans Hub and AusPath and other things. And yeah,
for me, and the research I want to do and the community I want to help build, is that you know, to remind everybody that, you know, we are human, and to treat us with dignity, but also to kind of bring us all together, because we are stronger together and in partnership with our sister girls, the wider LGBTIQA+ community. Nobody wins until we all do. And I think we're looking at a particular dark time that's coming up with discussions of, you know, trans people and sport and rights, etc. And I think I know I can do a bit more in terms of community building. I think we need to really all kind of, you know, come together first in what capacity we can, but also to, you know, look at reclaiming our histories and reclaiming and, you know, the place that we had in culture pre-colonization. I'm particularly focused on as well, and hunting down conversations with people and trying to kind of understand a bit more, because you know, one half the country has these histories and one half the country doesn't. Well, kind of leads me to the belief that, you know, it's more forgotten and needs to be sort of remembered. Like, there's nothing in Wiradjuri culture that's ever disappears. It just has been forgotten. It just needs to be remembered and transformed. So for me, it's about first bringing the brother boys together, trying to build upon the community that's already there. We do have brother boy elders, we do have, you know, beginnings of conversations and networks, but just to take it that sort of next step further, somehow get sort of funding and a little bit more of a targeted sort of approach with dignity. But also the bigger picture is not just about being Aboriginal, it's about trans people being treated respectfully in the medical service. And I think, you know, that work around treating people as human beings, because with my observations of the trans community and trans people, you have day in, day out, little microaggressions, day in, day out. And where the suicidality and ideation starts to happen is you never know what that one microaggression that's going to be that microaggression that leads to a young person taking their life. So a lot of work around, you should feel safe going to a doctor. You should feel like you get medical attention when you need it, and not that you're going to be treated any differently as a trans person without dignity. So I think those conversations around access and equity and dignity for trans people, looking at the intersectionality of being Aboriginal as well, I think that's really important, because it's, you know, whilst the numbers of trans people aren't high, the suicide rates within that community is high.
Yeah, I think, like, it'd be great. We had about 6 years ago, we had a brother boy sister girl retreat called Kunga in Melbourne, and that was really fantastic. So it'd be great if we could do something like that again. And I think in general, when I talk general, I'm talking about transgender brother boy sister girl, having that knowledge, having medical professionals having that knowledge of how to treat transgender people with dignity and respect, but also being able to access services and support more easily. So being able to do informed consent, having gender affirmation surgeries that are covered by Medicare, you know, not having, well, I can't even, you know, if I wanted to get bottom surgery, you'd be looking at $80,000 plus. So that's not achievable for me.
Yeah.
I would like to get it, but, you know, it's just ridiculous, the cost of some of the things, you know, and some people, it's not a choice because they just cannot simply afford it. Even to access testosterone, like, there was a change a few years ago where Primatestin, which is, you have it every 2 weeks, it became unavailable because of supply issues, and then you had to go to Reandron. And if you don't see a specialist or a sexual health worker to get it as a authority script, you have to pay full price, which is, you know, $100 and something. So just the constant hoops that we have to jump through just to access support and services to transition, and even just to change our birth certificate gender market. There's lots and lots of barriers, which I think's really out of our control, but hopefully with more acceptance and
it's about how you can put it in your
control. So
it's about how you can start leveraging some of that, or even about who do you start to talk to.
Maybe we can find, like, a billionaire philanthropist who will help support put up, like, a trust fund that we can help support a community. I can only dream, but yeah, there's lots of things. Like, I think we are moving in a positive direction. I know, like, I am with Jack that there are some concerns around, you know, especially with things that are going on in the USA at the moment, regards to transphobia and attacks against transgender people and brother boys and sister girls. And I do think we are slowly moving in a positive way, but it's, you know,
it's time.
Yeah, and I don't know, like, it's not something I really think about a lot now because I've started transitioning 7 years ago, so.
Yeah.
But, you know, I'm just hoping that the changes that we make and the way we influence will have a positive impact on younger generations that come through.
Well, that's fantastic. Thank you very much for sharing all of that fantastic knowledge and experiences.